Hello, you're listening to Gays Gaze, in which we're gay and we gaze into media that's by, for, or about ladies who love ladies, and sometimes we talk about other stuff. My name's Erin, and I can see by the way you dress, you don't give a hoot about how you look.
And my name's Erin, and attractive creature, but queer-tempered, I should think. Difficult to know.
Oh.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh. Who could it
be? Are you talking about a lesbian?
Am I talking about Rebecca?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about Rebecca.
Yeah.
Sorry for the late episode, you guys. I was sick. Erin was also sick. Don't know how that happened. We're on opposite sides of the damn country.
Yeah.
Tis the season.
Tis the season. Oh my gosh. It was very unfair. I had the flu and then
very unfair.
Had a cold.
You had a cold, yeah. And then you got another cold.
Yeah.
I also think that that happened to me.
Yeah.
I got a cold and then I also think I got a second cold on top of my cold. I don't sound the best, but
no,
I sound
a
lot better than I did before. I also didn't have as much time. Here's the thing, Erin. Rebecca is a series that is so near and dear to my heart. I love this book so much. I love the movie adaptation, the Hitchcock one. I just think it's so smart. It's so fun.
It's so good. And you love the 2020 remake.
I don't love the 2020 remake. No, I thought that was one of the worst movies I've ever seen, quite honestly. And I'm ready to talk about that later. But I was so excited to like really hyperfixate on this and do like a really mega deep dive and get like all my sources and shit in order. That just did not happen. This is I was sick. But you know what? It's fine because I'm here to talk about Rebecca with all the passion in my heart of a young 21-year-old Mrs. De Winter. So, and with the flattest, sickest voice of all time, I do feel fine, though. And I am ready for Rebecca.
She's 21?
Yes, she's 21. How old did you think she was?
I thought she was 16.
No, she's 21.
Okay.
They say in the book that at some point she says she's 21 and then he says he's twice her age. He's 42. So.
Oh my God. That makes it so much better. Okay. Trying to find an audiobook so I could listen to Rebecca at work. I did find one that didn't have a huge waiting list. However, it was an abridged version. So in the abridged version, they do not clarify. All I heard is people saying like, you look like a teenager, and him being like, I could be your dad. And I was like, oh, she's like 16.
No. She's
okay, that's good to know.
She is 21.
Okay.
And they say, she says at one point, like, oh, to be a girl of 21 or something like that, you know. She definitely still sees herself as being very young and very inexperienced, which you are at the age of 21, quite honestly.
Yeah.
But it's only mentioned once and in passing. And then, like, if you look up anything about Rebecca, it says she's somewhere in her early 20s. But I believe she does say at one point in like one instance that she's 21. So.
Okay.
Yeah, she does read as younger. I mean, the whole book is about coming into being a woman, right? That's like one of the themes, along with like jealousy and murder and miscommunications. I mean, there's a lot of themes going on, but definitely like growing up and coming into womanhood is one of the major themes here. So I first read Rebecca when I was in high school. I got assigned to read Rebecca for like a class project when our teacher handpicked books that she thought that people would like, which is so funny to me now. I never interpreted this as a queer book when I was a teenager and reading it. I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily interpret it as a queer book. I think a lot of the queer aspects of the book are shrouded in metaphor, making your inference, right? As a reader, you have to infer that the book is queer to get it. It's like the queer audience who reads it knows, right?
Yeah.
This book was massively popular. It's never went out of print in the 80 years since its release. And it said that it still sells 4,000 copies monthly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I could see why this book was thrilling. It's so good from start to finish.
I'm so glad you loved it.
I loved it so much. I'm like so sad that I couldn't get the full copy. But I'm excited that when my hold is available that I can just listen to the whole thing because it was like that good. The book was my favorite version of this,
yes.
Of the like three things that we consumed for this episode. The Hitchcock movie is, of course, really good and really beautiful, but, like, the book itself is perfection.
Yes, the book is the best because it's told from the protagonist's perspective as opposed to, obviously, it's a lot harder to do that in a movie. They didn't even really try with a Hitchcock movie. That said, the Hitchcock movie is very faithful. There are a few serious changes, I would say, but for the most part, it is very faithful to the book. Mm-hmm. The 2020 adaptation is one of the least faithful book to movie adaptations I've ever seen. We'll talk about that later. But are you ready to talk about the plot of Rebecca?
I am.
I will give spoilers, and trust me when I say this, if you like suspense and you like gothic romance novels, you're going to want to read this if you haven't. So if you haven't read it, definitely go and do that. Listen to the audiobook.
The twist in this had me gagged.
I'm excited to talk with you about that because I feel like I predicted the twist from a mile away. But then I also, there are things about the twist that are surprising.
Yeah,
I'll also give content warnings that murder and suicide are huge plot points here, as well as psychologically abusive and manipulative relationships. There's some hints at potential grooming as well. There's a very big age difference in the couple and the protagonist and her husband. As we said, she's 21, he's 42, and he frequently talks about how he's attracted to her because she's youthful, innocent, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So there is also that as well. That said, it's not going to be like turbo gory or anything, but it definitely does have themes of abusive relationships pretty heavily throughout. So in Rebecca, we follow a 21-year-old English woman who has a unique name that we will never get to know. She's a nameless protagonist, and she will remain nameless throughout the rest of the book. She is working as a paid companion to a very wealthy older woman named Mrs. Van Hopper, and they're on vacation in Monte Carlo. While they're there, the two of them meet Mr. Maxim de Winter, who is a wealthy 42-year-old widower. When Mrs. Van Hopper falls ill with a bout of the flu, our protagonist starts spending more and more time socializing with Maxim in the hotel. He takes her out for drives in his car. They have lunch together. He tells our protagonist about his wooded seaside mansion, Manderley, which has been in their family's possession for generations, and which, coincidentally, our protagonist had a framed painting of growing up that she was obsessed with. So we're getting a little bit of that, like, fangirl falling in love with her idol vibe to it a little bit, but early, you know, because it's the 1930s. And our protagonist also learns that Maxim's wife, Rebecca, passed away not even a year ago. And over the next few weeks, while Mrs. Van Hopper is sick and under a nurse's care, they develop a very strong friendship, and there's a feeling that there is something more going on. Suddenly, Mrs. Van Hopper is all well, she's cured of her flu, and she wants to leave for New York as soon as possible. Our protagonist is totally distraught. She doesn't want this relationship with Maxim to end, and she struggles to find him to tell him that they're leaving immediately. When she does break the news to him, he gives her a choice. She can marry him and move with him to Manderley, or she can follow Mrs. Van Hopper to New York. Obviously, she chooses to marry him and to move to Manderley. He breaks the news to Mrs. Van Hopper, who then tells her that she believes that she is making a grave mistake and that she will not be able to handle being in charge of the Manderley estate. They get married. She has become Mrs. De Winter. This is the only name that she will ever have throughout the course of this book, the new Mrs. De Winter. They honeymoon together in Italy, and then they return to Manderley. When they return, she's greeted by the staff, and that includes the butlers, Frith and Robert, a whole bunch of housemaids, and also the keeper of the house, Mrs. Danvers. Mrs. Danvers is a skull with a human's face. She was incredibly close with the former Mrs. De Winter, Rebecca. And she also emits an evil energy to Mrs. De Winter from the very start. It seems very suspicious. There was something more going on, and it seems like she might be out to get her. But being a kind young girl, she obviously decides to give Mrs. Danvers the benefit of the doubt. Will that be a mistake? We will see. So as Mrs. De Winter is settling into Manderley, it's clear that no one has removed any of Rebecca's belongings in preparation. It's still Rebecca's house. It's perfectly as she had kept it. So is the schedule, the menus, which Mrs. De Winter is expected to abide by and basically fill Rebecca's shoes. And Rebecca was a prominent socialite, and up until her untimely drowning in her own ship, she was beloved by everyone in the town. Everyone was obsessed with her. So the new Mrs. De Winter is a very shy young woman who has no experience partying or organizing events. She's described as being very plain looking, or that's how she would describe herself. She also describes herself as having, you know, very basic clothes. The maids are making fun of how dirty and dingy and old her underwear are. Like, it's that level, you know? It's like, she's not a wealthy girl. She was an orphan. How could she possibly live up to the beautiful, perfect socialite Rebecca? It combined with this, Maxim, as soon as they get to Manderley, he starts seeming really eerily distant, and he frequently expresses that he never should have brought her back to Manderley, which it has a bad ring to it. It gives a bad feeling, you know, to hear your husband say, I never should have brought you here.
Yeah, especially since everybody is telling her that he was so in love with Rebecca. Yes. And he never got over it. Like, even from the moment that of their engagement, Mrs. Van Hopper, like, put in her brain, like, oh, you're never going to be able to live up to Rebecca.
Exactly.
And so she is just, like, it is eating at her.
Yeah, it's all she can think about. Yeah. And then she meets Maxim's best friend, who is the house's accountant, Frank, and he offers some comfort and says that he thinks that she's great for Maxim and he's so glad that she's there. But he also confirms some of her fears when she asks if he thought that Rebecca was beautiful, and he confirms that she was, quote, the most beautiful creature he'd ever seen. So take note to some of this language, right? I never should have brought you to Manderley. She was the most beautiful creature I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And same when she meets Maxim's sister and her husband as well. They tell her that they're very charmed by her. They like the new Mrs. De Winter a lot, and they're very glad that she's married Maxim. But at the same time, no one could possibly live up to Rebecca. I mean, she was really getting up to a lot of stuff, if you know what I mean. So...
And the new Mrs. De Winter is like, I don't know what you mean.
I don't know what
I feel
any of
very
this means.
Sad.
I know, yeah. So all the while, there's all that going on. And then at the same time, Mrs. Danvers is there. And she's hinting, or not even hinting, but just openly saying that the new Mrs. De Winter is never going to live up to Rebecca. And Maxim's never going to love her as much as he loved Rebecca. And, you know, she's like, I just got to try to be more like Rebecca. These are big shoes to fill, but I'm going to put them on. I am going to revive the family's annual fancy dress ball, a.k.a. the masquerade. And this is an annual party that they've always had. She's like, well, let's bring it back. You know, that seems kind of like a lower stakes thing for me to coordinate since it's an annual event. I don't have to personally invite anybody. We'll just invite the whole town.
And everybody's telling her how much they miss the fancy
dress
ball, too.
Exactly. Everybody's like,
wow,
we loved
it.
Are
you going to host it? Because she's like, of course I am.
Yeah, I'll do it. But then she's struggling to come up with a costume idea. And Mrs. Danvers suggests that she dresses one of the paintings from the hall. The Mrs. decides that this is a great idea. She's so excited to reveal her costume, and she keeps it a secret from everyone until the night of the party. And on the night of the ball, she debuts her costume. She's feeling so proud, so beautiful, like she's finally looking, you know, as beautiful as Rebecca could have, you know. And the second that she walks down the stairs in horror, Maxim reacts by screaming at her that she needs to change immediately into literally anything else before any of the guests arrive. She runs off crying, and she finds out that Mrs. Danvers has set her up. This was the exact same costume that Rebecca wore to the last ball. Absolutely
so
horrible.
Heartbreaking.
It's the first moment that she starts feeling comfortable in her skin, you know.
Yeah.
So right after the ball, Mrs. De Winter confronts Mrs. Danvers to be like, how dare you do that to me? You know, she's finally getting some confidence, and she's willing to stand up for herself. She is the lady of the house. She has the right to tell the housekeeper what to do. And when she does this, Mrs. Danvers reveals that she only feels contempt for the new Mrs. Mrs. Danvers hates her. She thinks that she'll never be as cool as Rebecca was. And then she tries to talk our protagonist into suicide. She encourages her to jump out of a window and basically pushes her right up to the windowsill and is like, jump, do it.
Yeah.
However, they are interrupted when sirens alarm to alert that there is a ship emergency in the nearby bay. A diver has discovered Rebecca's sailing boat and a body is on board. It is Rebecca's.
Ugh.
Yes. So both Maxim and Mrs. De Winter are shocked by this discovery, but unexpectedly for very different reasons. Mrs. De Winter knows that Maxim identified another body as Rebecca's, and that woman is buried in the family tomb. So she's like, how could this have happened? How could you have misidentified the first body? But Maxim reveals that he knew Rebecca was on that ship all along because he was the one who put her body there. He killed her. Dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
But you didn't expect this.
I didn't. And I do kind of wonder if this was partly because I was listening to an abridged version. And so they were very selective, which what scenes they were, you know, choosing to do or not. But yeah, I was gooped and gagged completely.
Did you think that Rebecca died of natural causes?
It seemed like kind of fishy.
Or like just an accident. Yeah.
I was kind of buying into the hype. I was like, wow, she seems great. She seems so perfect. It's so sad she died. Maxim was really in love with her. I was like fully enthralled. I was right there with the new Mrs. De Winter being like, dang.
When they put you in the eyes and the perspective, when you're hearing everything from her side, you really do expect that, like, the only person who maybe could have killed her was somebody in the town who, like, hated her. Right?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I guess maybe you wouldn't necessarily expect that Maxim did it. When I read this as a teenager, I always thought that Maxim did it. I was like, I think yeah. Maxim killed her. I just don't know how. And I thought that for a variety of reasons. He was being very fishy when they first met.
That's fair. He was being a freak.
He was being weird about it. And
then he continued to be a freak.
And he continued to be weird. And you know what? His reason for killing her, is it good or bad? I don't know. That's part of the plot. You know, it's you make your own interpretation about it. So let's talk about why Maxim killed Rebecca. Mm-hmm. So Maxim hated Rebecca. After their wedding, she revealed a secret that he says is far too vile to even share with the Mrs. De Winter. What could that secret be? Let's pontificate on that one in a little bit. But Rebecca never loved Maxim. She only ever wanted to manipulate him into letting her run Manderley herself. She just always wanted to have the life of a socialite. And she had affairs with men constantly, but Mrs. Danvers, too, just agrees that they were just her plaything. She had never felt any love for any of the men that she ever had sex with.
And she even goes so to say that, like, Rebecca used to come back to Mrs. Danvers and laugh about how stupid the men were.
Yeah, I know. And only Mrs. Danvers could have possibly understood Rebecca.
I know. Oh my God. Yeah. It's so juicy.
Anyway. Maxim absolutely hated his life with her, and she was ruthlessly mean to him for their whole relationship. The final straw was when she told him that she was pregnant with her own cousin's baby, which she would then raise as Maxim's child and who would then inherit Manderley. And in a rage, Maxim shot her and killed her. He placed her body on the sailboat. He intentionally sunk it himself, and then he rowed himself back to shore. He knew that the day would come that his secret was discovered, but he hoped that he would at least have gotten to spend more time with the new Mrs. De Winters before he would be found and hanged for his crime.
Mm-hmm.
Juicy. So juicy.
Yeah.
And perhaps, in my opinion, the juiciest part, Mrs. De Winter is surprised, but suddenly this realization, everything makes sense now. All of the barriers and disconnections she felt from Maxim are gone. She's yeah. like, I do love this man, and he does love me, and this is for real.
Yeah.
And I spent all this time trying to be Rebecca, but I never should have, because he hated Rebecca.
Yeah,
If I was successful, damn, my marriage would have been ruined.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I'm not Rebecca, actually. And anyway, I love my husband, and I'm going to try to do what I can so that he doesn't get caught for this murder and killed.
Yeah.
Wild reaction, first of all.
So funny.
It's interesting. And two, Rebecca, you know, as much as the 2020 movie would lead you to believe, is not that horny of a book. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty sexless story.
Yeah.
But when this murder is revealed, things are getting a little hot and heavy between these two, actually.
They are so horny for murder.
They're really horny about this. This one really got them going. And so after this, there is obviously an inquisition that is opened up to investigate how Rebecca died. Who was the other person? How did all of this happen? You know, they discover that the boat was deliberately sunk. It is considered to be a suicide in the end. However, after the case is closed, Rebecca's cousin, purported father of the baby, accuses Maxim of murder and blackmails him for money because he loves gambling and drinking.
Yeah.
On principle, Maxim is like, I would never cave to blackmail. I'm calling the colonel right now to continue the investigation. To which Mrs. De Winter is like, on God? For real?
And she's like, oh.
She's like, oh, why would you do that? Give him money. You fool, pay him off.
Yeah.
Anyway, they do continue the investigation, and they discover that Rebecca had a doctor's appointment in London on the day that she died. And so they go to meet with the doctor. He tells the colonel he never saw a Rebecca De Winter, but he did see one Mrs. Rebecca Danvers. And she was definitely not pregnant, but she did have uterine cancer, and she only had a few months left to live. The rest of her life would have been excruciatingly painful, and he had just broken the news to her on the day that she died. That is obviously enough evidence to clear Maxim's name and give a motive for Rebecca's suicide. Maxim is also totally shocked by this news. He never in a million years could have guessed that Rebecca had manipulated him into killing her so that she could avoid a slow and painful death.
That Rebecca, she's a crafty one.
She really is. As Maxim and Mrs. De Winter pack up from London to head back to Manderley, Maxim gets news from Frank that Mrs. Danvers has packed her bags and she's run away into the woods. Don't know where she's going. She's not at Manderley anymore. And after this call, Maxim has a horrible, horrible gut feeling. He rushes them back to Manderley, and when they pull up to the drive, they find the entire mansion and forest ablaze. And that's how the book ends.
An incredible ending.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Gut-wrenching. Literally just like the line of like, and it was Manderley. Like.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. I love that finish.
Yeah, me too. Such a good story. And by good, I mean complicated, tricky, messy, yucky, fun.
It's fun. It's thrilling.
It's thrilling. I read an article on The Guardian by Olivia Lang where they said the quote, there are two sunken ships, a murder, a fire, a costume party, and multiple complex betrayals. And yet it's startling to realize how much of its drama never actually happens. Which just also made me think about when we read and watched Onisama E. My quote was, it feels like everything's happening so much, but then in reality it's like, oh, she fell down. And that really is also the exact same vibe that Rebecca is giving, where it's like you're getting the peek into this girl's brain about all of the melodrama that she's seeing, that she's interpreting, and none of it is even real, and there's something totally different going on that she has no idea about.
Yeah.
And, yeah, none of it ever actually happened. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything. I mean, the minute she gets to Manderley, they're like, oh, here's where you can write your letters. Rebecca used to write her letters every morning after breakfast. And this poor girl is freaking out. She's like, I don't have anybody to write letters to.
What am I going to do?
What am I going to do?
Yeah. Or the plot point where she breaks the Cupid statue on the desk. And then it's like, yeah. Oh, my God, I broke the statue. Then they're going to fire the butler. And then she's like, I couldn't possibly tell because I'm so embarrassed. And then Maxim's like, well, aren't you even more embarrassed now that you didn't tell? And now you're going to have to go and make a big to-do about why you didn't speak up about it. So anyway, off and do your little duty. And then at the end of the day, he's like, I hated that Cupid statue. Rebecca bought it and it was ugly anyway. So like, who cares?
Man.
And yeah, it's like... Again, like, none of it matters.
Communication would have solved, like, half these things.
Exactly. And even Rebecca's death is one of those things that it's like, oh, none of this even mattered. Like, yeah, you shot and killed her. She wanted to die anyway, so... Yeah, one of the pervasive ideas is, right, that Rebecca kind of gets the last win.
Yeah.
There's this idea of, like, this is how Rebecca can still win. My Bernie Sanders joke. This is how Rebecca can still win. If Mrs. Danvers will just set fucking Manderly on fire and run away into the woods, then Rebecca still wins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? Good for her.
And I love this for being a ghost story where the ghost is not an actual ghost at all. The ghost is like the memories that other people have of the person who have died and the physical items that the person leaves behind. The ghost is the letterbox that still has Rebecca's name on it. The ghost is pulling out the business card or whatever out of the raincoat pocket. The ghost is going into the West Wing and seeing Rebecca's lacy little nightgown. And the ghost is Mrs. Danvers, who's alive and well, but who has the essence of a spirit and is still carrying Rebecca with her.
Oh, yes. Still doing her bidding to the best of her abilities.
Yeah.
That aspect of the story is amazing. It's so haunting. And again, even though, like, nothing really happens, you feel for the protagonist and all of this stuff. That was what also made me think about Onisama A, because you have this, like, kind of, like, young person thrust into this, like, situation where they don't know the full picture. And then there are also all these societal rules that they also don't know how to abide by, and they're trying their best, but their best is not enough because nobody is helping them.
I know. To me, it's always a very relatable and very interesting and very compelling storyline to see something like that play out.
Yeah. I think that's also kind of why I thought she was still a teenager, is just that this is like peak, I am suffering because my brain hasn't fully developed kind of moments.
Yeah. I mean, her brain still has not fully developed.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, totally. Let's talk about some sapphic stuff.
Yeah.
The author, Daphne du Maurier, first of all, actually, I guess before we get into the sapphic stuff, I should say, I was surprised to learn that she described Rebecca as a study in jealousy, and she admitted that it was based on her own real life experience. Which gagged me, because her husband had had a previous fiance who was a glamorous dark-haired beauty, and she always, like, kind of related to the protagonist of the story, which I thought was very interesting. Yeah, so she wrote it from some first-person perspective. However, their marriage, they did frequently cheat on one another later in life. They did not have a strong marriage by any means. And when she died in 1989, a biography was written about her life that revealed that she was bisexual. She had fallen in love with her publisher's wife, Ellen Doubleday. She had also had an affair with an actress named Gertrude Lawrence, even though that actress's family still denies it to this day. There are also many theories that Daphne du Maurier may have been transgender. So we're using she, her pronouns because that's what du Maurier used throughout her whole life. That said, she often said that she wished that she had been born a boy. When she first met Ellen Doubleday, she said that she had felt, quote, a boy of 18 again. Keyword again, to be a boy of age 18 again is an interesting way to phrase it.
Yeah.
And also, it's reported that when she was a child, she convinced herself that she was a boy, and she was devastated when people around her told her otherwise. Later in life, she described herself as, quote, half-breed, unquote, and that she didn't fit into any particular category. And there are a lot of theories that today, if she were alive today, perhaps she would have identified as a transgender man.
Yeah.
Just based on all of that experience, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I know that there are many, many, many scholars that have done deep dives on Daphne du Maurier's life, as Daphne du Maurier is a very prolific author. As I said, like, this book is probably her most famous, and it's still so frequently read today. And there are many people who have talked at length about the queer aspects of Daphne du Maurier's life. Unfortunately, again, because I was sick, I didn't have as much time to do that deep dive as I wanted to. But those are just some of the tidbits that I was able to pick out. So,
yeah, I was reading more about, I know her children have denied the alleged intimate relationships with women, but it seems like she's gay, or she was at least bisexual.
Yeah. Anyway. Yes, yes. Before we move on to talking about the movies and the other adaptations, there are two more things about the book. So one, there have been multiple sequels to Rebecca. None of them are by Daphne du Maurier.
Okay.
Which is interesting. I haven't read any of them. I have no idea if they would be any good or what they could possibly be about, because this is it's a concise story. You know, it's not one that needs a sequel.
The Alfred Hitchcock movie and the 2020 movie, they both continue on after Manderley is shown to be burning.
Yes.
And I think that's totally unnecessary and like makes the story not as good.
Yeah,
yeah,
I
it
agree.
Detracts. So having a whole nother story after the end of Rebecca, just I'm like, there is no appeal there for me.
I know. Yeah, I know the most prominent sequel is just called Mrs. De Winter. We should talk about the plot before we talk about the movies. There are still a few plot points I think we should go over too, now that I'm thinking about it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let's do it.
But the other thing is that Rebecca the book, I did not realize this either, it faced multiple plagiarism allegations. It was not found guilty of any of them. Some of the other novels that it was accused of plagiarizing include A Sucessora by Nabucco. I'm probably mispronouncing that, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this title as well. Encarnacion by de Alencar and Blind Windows by MacDonald were all accusing Rebecca of plagiarizing their stories. Elea said it was not found guilty of any of those allegations, but all of them were made, and apparently all of them do have similar plots. I think a story about like the widower and like what happened to his wife is not Rebecca, it's not that unique of a story, quite honestly.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't know, maybe it actually was plagiarizing though, so I don't want to write that off either, but yeah,
that's fair.
I would love to, before we talk about the movies too, I would just love to talk about Mrs. Danvers and her being gay while we're talking about sapphic shit.
Yes.
Too.
Oh my goodness.
I spent a lot of the book being like, why is she Mrs. Danvers? Who is Mr. Danvers? I was gagged when we get to the reveal with the doctor. That's what the murder gagged you. What gagged me was the doctor being like, yeah, I have one Mrs. Rebecca Danvers here, and me putting the fucking puzzle pieces together where I'm like, oh, she's Mrs. Danvers because Rebecca is the other Mrs. Danvers. Duh. Fucking duh. The other thing that just made so much sense too was that thing about, let's go all the way back where I was like, hold on to this, when Maxim was like, she had a secret that she told me on our honeymoon that was so vile I could never tell anybody else what it was. It's that she was gay. Duh.
Yeah.
Like, that's what the secret was. Like, it's so obvious now, right? Like, there's no other thing that it could possibly be, because so much of it was like, Rebecca, she never liked any men. She always had this incredibly intimate relationship with Mrs. Danvers, and Mrs. Danvers was the only person she ever trusted. Also, if we are talking about the grooming themes as well, we can't just be talking about the new Mrs. De Winters and Maxim, because that grooming is definitely a theme with them as well. But Mrs. Danvers was also Rebecca's childhood maid, and stayed with her throughout her whole life, and it's very obvious that the two of them were in love as well, which is also very suspicious. They never tell us what the ages were. It's like, maybe she became Miss Rebecca's maid when Rebecca was like 20 or whatever.
Yeah,
she's like, I saw
know.
Her grow up, blah 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 blah. Like, I
yeah
don't know.
I guess my kind of take on that, because like the maid that's given to the new Mrs. De Winter is kind of like supposedly around her age, and I kind of thought like this was some like maybe a little bit of like old-timey indentured servitude.
It might be
like this is, hey, our my maid works for this family but I have a daughter and she's around the age of your daughter. My daughter can take care of your daughter kind of thing. Because yeah. Mrs. De Winter is never kind of outlined to be particularly old, in my opinion.
Yeah. We don't know how old she was. We don't know how old Mrs. Danvers was. We do have the new Mrs. De Winter saying that Mrs. Danvers looks old, right?
That's fair.
But also Maxim's 42, right? So yeah. It's very possible she could also be like 42, 43. And then Rebecca was like also 42, 43 and like the same age as Mr. De Winter. So I don't know.
It's very easy to be like, she took care of her from childhood. She was older than her.
Yeah.
But even in the way that like, you know, the men hear, oh, she gave the name of Rebecca Danvers at the doctor's, it's because she really trusted Mrs. Danvers. Even that gives to me swoop over the head, like straights don't get it kind of a thing.
Yes, exactly. And especially knowing that Daphne du Maurier was queer too, it's like, well, duh, like, of course. And this is the era again of Pulp Fiction. Sorry, my voice. We're getting all these novels that have to have a bad ending for gay people, right? It's like, if you're writing about gay people, it's not going to get published unless you give them a horrible, tragic ending, like conversion therapy or death, or writing them in as the villain, which is also what's happening here, right? Or is it? I would also be happy to argue that Maxim is the true villain of the story, too. Because
yes,
even,
for real.
And that's the thing, is that you're getting Mrs. De Winter's perspective. Is she also not... She's also complicit in this woman's murder, right? At the same time, it was also a suicide, right? It's a very complicated situation, which is part of the reason why I love it so much. It's just so easy to pick at, you know?
Rebecca is playing everybody right up until the end.
She is.
Up until
or
the last
is she?
Moment. She's, you know, that's also, that's, I guess I, the way I see it, I like to give her the agency of, like, she's like, fucking shit up. But, I mean, honestly, Maxim, like, he is a scumbag, to be real.
He's not good either.
Like, who knows? Like, so much of that we hear from Rebecca is from somebody who hated her.
Yeah, exactly. And the snippets that we do hear from other people, it's like, we liked her, but we had a lingering suspicion that something was off, other than Frank, who openly does not like her. When we think about, oh, I suppose she was the most beautiful creature I ever done saw, or whatever it is that he said, it's very obvious in that point that he's like, yeah, she was physically attractive, but like, God, was she nasty. You know? Ooh, God, was she mean.
But he also, like, it seems like knew about the murder. From Maxim, so who knows?
Oh,
he might have been poisoned.
Well, yeah, and Maxim too. At one point, he's like, "I've never told Frank, but like he knows," which is also that's also such a funny theme where it's like, does he? Because like Mrs. De Winter spent all this time thinking she knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah,
and she didn't. She had no idea. No. So does Frank? I don't know. Yeah,
Maxim, communication is not your strong
suit.
Just
fucking tell people. Yeah, you could tell Frank. For real. Wouldn't turn you into the police. He loves you. Frank is also gay.
Even the police. At the very end, it's hinted that the police chief knows that Maxim was actually involved in the situation and writes it off as a suicide anyway.
Yeah, it's if not confirmed.
Yeah, they don't care.
And that that's another big plot point where it's like, oh yeah, the police are totally biased in this man's favor because he's rich. And Rebecca's cousin was an alcoholic and poor. And so why would he be taken seriously by the cops? The cops, of course, are going to favor Maxim because he's like a well-spoken, educated, rich man, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's open too. So.
Oh yeah, for real.
Yeah. I interpreted this as a critique of law enforcement as well.
Oh, definitely.
And also definitely, it's definitely vague as to whether or not, I think a lot of people probably do walk away with the idea that Maxim's a good guy and that he was in the right here and that this was, it's very obvious that this was a psychologically abusive relationship. That's fair enough. If we're taking Maxim's word for it, then that's very, very obvious. At the same time, up and killing your wife is a pretty big step.
Oh, yeah. There's... Yeah, and one thing I guess I should clarify too, when I was saying Rebecca was playing everybody until the end, I don't really buy the, like, oh, she goaded me into killing her, like, she, like, blah, blah, blah. I think that her cousin, who reveals the note that Rebecca, like, intended to see him that night, mm-hmm. like, has a very strong point of, like, she was not intending to kill herself. Like, I think yeah. that's, like, a pretty... Yeah, I think that's, like, pretty good evidence on his side. Nobody believes him.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I mean, you can also very easily make the argument that this is a rare early, and I say it's rare because it's so early in literature, a rare early depiction of a male victim of domestic violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a situation in which he really truly has been fully conned into doing this, right? And that this has been just psychological torture every single step of the way for this man. And that's also, mm-hmm. I think that's a very valid reading to take of this. I do still think that what's suspicious is his behavior towards the new Mrs. De Winter after all of this has happened. And, yeah. His interactions with the cops also afterwards are very weird. And the fact that, like, it's so... a frequent thing that Mrs. De Winter is talking about is the fact that he flies into a rage at the drop of a hat.
Yes.
And that yeah. is also where it's like, okay, this is an interesting take on, like, who's the victim, who's the abuser, I guess.
Yeah.
If you consider that interesting.
Because I think you could take it two ways with that, of, like, him flying into a rage is... indicative of the fact that he was, mm-hmm. you know, a poor person himself, a potentially even an abusive person himself. Or, you know, I mean, if you wanted to go in that direction, you could also be that, like, him having gigantic mood swings are a result of him being abused for many years.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you for putting that into better words than I put it with my sick brain. That's exactly what I mean. Yes. Like, you really could interpret it either way, where it's like, who knows what the fuck happened? You know who doesn't know what the fuck happened? It's Mrs. De Winter doesn't know what the fuck happened.
Yeah, she sure doesn't.
That's the point. Yeah.
And Maxim's not going to tell her in any clear terms.
But what we do know is that she's happy with him and that they're living a peaceful and great life in their hotel or whatever after Manderly burns down. It's fine.
Oh, no.
Do I think that, like, the who's the victim, who's the abuser narrative is interesting? Honestly, no, I personally don't. But I do still think that the story in general is really interesting from being told from the perspective of the neutral third party, really, of Mrs. De Winter, who's just trying to figure out what the fuck is going on, just like the rest of us are.
But I think this is, a really interesting depiction of the, like, who's who in this situation because of the protagonist, like, being so unaware of everything that is going on. Going way, way back, I'm so sorry, to what I was saying before, is, like, when I say that, like, Rebecca was really pulling the strings, like, I kind of mean that in, like a supernatural, omnipresent kind of way, because there are so many moments of, like, you know, her cousin coming in with the letter, of having Mrs. Danvers come in with her testimony, and it's not, like, what you kind of expect. And kind of, like, all of these things that, like, new trails that kind of lead the characters each and every way of not being exactly sure what's going to happen. And up until the end point, Mrs. Danvers burning down the only thing that we know for a fact Maxim really loves, which is his estate. And I do, like, I you know what? I love that for Rebecca.
Yeah, it's like, if it can't be Rebecca's, then it can't be anybody else's. Sorry.
Yeah, so true. So true. She does seem to be, like, that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And again, I know we're talking about this a lot. The reveal of the death is interesting because there is the question of, like, is this actually what Rebecca wanted, to die instead of, like, having to play out this really painful death by cancer. But, oh, fuck, what was I going to say? No, my fucking thought is gone. That sucks. I don't remember what I was going
to
say.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to say this and hopefully it comes back to you and then we can talk about it. I just think it's really interesting that we spend the whole book learning about how making assumptions gets you nowhere and making assumptions, like, only hurts you. And then we find out that Rebecca had cancer and it's like, oh, so she wanted to die? Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine then. God, so we can so just assume real. And then just keep moving forward. Like, has the whole lesson of the book not been to teach us to be critical of the assumptions that you're making? And then we get to the end and it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, it's what she would have wanted.
Yeah, so. She probably intended to do that.
So that's why I have to be critical of it, right? Because we've literally spent the whole book being told to be critical about it.
Yeah. And I also find it kind of suspicious because, you know, that is presented as a like, well, okay, Maxim didn't, you know, Maxim can be redeemed from being a murderer, which is generally considered like not really that great because like potentially he was like tricked into doing it or like goaded into doing it or like she wanted it in the first place. But it is interesting to watch the investigation of the murder play out because Maxim does seem to feel very guilty about it and does kind of seem to be on multiple occasions kind of ready to accept the fact that like he's gonna just go to jail for this because he did murder her straight up.
And to me that reads more into the believability of the Maxim truly was the person who was being abused this whole time, and that to me that is what leads into that, because it's like, well, if he's so willing to accept his fate and accept the fact that he did this horrible thing, then he's probably not that bad of a person actually. That's what my first thought is, unless he's manipulating the situation again but that's that feels less likely to me, I guess.
You know, I don't know. It's a lot to chew on.
That's why I love it.
Great characters. Yeah. Wonderful story. Totally thrilling. Amazing.
Gripping. Yeah. And that's why it's been adapted into so many other things. So let's talk about that. So there's a lot of adaptations we didn't get into. There have been many television adaptations, including one that I was very interested in, which is a Pakistani television drama adaptation that looks very interesting. Also some British adaptations from all over the world. There have been radio shows, live theater productions, and even an opera made of Rebecca. However, two of the most famous adaptations, which we did watch both of them, was the 1940 Alfred Hitchcock film adaptation and the 2020 Ben Wheatley film adaptation in Netflix original. So let's start with Hitchcock. And then we'll end our episode on some sipping some Haterade with that Ben Wheatley adaptation.
Oh my God. The Hitchcock one. It's really amazing. There's some incredible shots. Exactly what you'd expect from a Hitchcock movie. I did think it was interesting that the ending is changed where the new Mrs. De Winter just kind of goes home for the end of the investigation. They're like, you shouldn't go to the doctor's office with us. And then Maxim is kind of like finding out the end of the story with his guy friend. And then also seeing Manderley Birding with his guy friend instead of it being with the new Mrs. De Winter.
Yeah. Again, leading a little bit more into the gay theming of this movie. I mean, the most interesting twist. So the movie, I will say, is very faithful for the most part to the book. There are entire sections of the movie where they're speaking so fast, and it's because they're trying to cram in like all the dialogue from the actual book into the movie. Like almost every like conversation is transferred verbatim. And so at that point, it's less about the storytelling and the scripting, and it's more about the stylistic choices and the casting that is more interesting to me. Because it's like you really are getting a more accurate picture of just what the book is, but you're getting the visuals with it. And I really liked all the casting. I thought that all of the characters looked like how I would have envisioned them in my head, except for maybe Mrs. Danvers, who is described as being like exceptionally tall and like eerie and gaunt. So I would expect her to be maybe a little more scary looking.
Yeah, she's like the same size as the new Mrs. De Winter.
Yeah.
Maybe even a little bit shorter. And she's not nearly as angular as like I imagined her.
And the new Mrs. De Winter as well is she's more beautiful than what you would imagine based on the novel.
Yeah. Yeah, people are mean to her. They're like, are you going to fix your hair? And meanwhile, her hair is perfect.
Yeah.
I will say Judith Anderson, who played Mrs. Danvers, absolutely killed it.
Yes. Oh, perfect 100%. Acting.
Oh my God.
She was not visually what I expected, but she slayed that role. Yeah. Yeah. She carried. She has
all of the vibes.
Yes, agreed. But the big change to me is the fact that they make the twist that Maxim didn't kill Rebecca after all. She just slipped and fell and died, which is like, why would you change that?
I don't know.
And I think that the reason that they changed it is probably to avoid people having those conversations about the... Because Daphne du Maurier was involved in writing the script for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe they talked about that, though, in Queer for Fear that we watched.
She's on IMDb. She's one of the writers.
It says that the screenplay, the adaptation was by Philip McDonald and Michael Hogan, not by Daphne du Maurier. But I believe that Daphne du Maurier was heavily involved in the production of this film. I believe she was also friends with Alfred Hitchcock. But my first thought when I saw that was, did they change that so that people are getting less hung up on Maxim's guilt and it's more clear that he was, that the intention was that he was not supposed to be to blame?
Potentially.
But yeah, making it so that he didn't actually murder her gives a lot less ambiguity to it. It's like, okay, so yeah, so he's, you know, he was in this abusive relationship and then his wife fell and died. But then he did still sink her ship for whatever reason and hide.
Yeah, he was like, oh, I don't know, understand. Everybody's gonna think I killed her. Let me make it look like I killed her.
Which made me also think that maybe he actually did kill her and was even in the movie and was lying about it. I don't know.
Who knows?
But that was the big change. And then Pepper just came in here and like did a backflip and yelled. Like, what was Pepper? That? Pepper. Anyway, and then the ending when they come and find Manderly and it's on fire and we see that Mrs. Danvers is inside the house.
She's
burning alive inside the house. We don't actually get to see her burn, but we can assume she's gonna burn to death in there. And she's dying just like Rebecca did. She's dying with Rebecca.
In Rebecca's wing, in her room.
Yes, she in Rebecca's room. Kept in
perfect
room.
Condition.
Yes, exactly.
I kind of love that for her, though.
I know.
But I love that for her because she was serving in this movie. I even more so love the book of her just getting away and she can go live her lesbian life somewhere else with Rebecca always in her heart.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was really good. I really like the Hitchcock adaptation despite some of those changes.
Yeah.
Still gripping. I remember the scene where she has to write the letters weirdly felt a lot more gripping in the movie because it's like, oh, she's sitting at the desk and there's all of Rebecca's shit. And then she's like, oh, God, who do I write to?
Yeah. Anxiety.
And then I watched the 2020 Ben Wheatley adaptation. Oh, my God. Erin, I told you not to watch it.
I know. It was so funny. You literally were like, don't watch it. And then I immediately sat down and watched it.
I know. I was like, literally, don't watch this. It is not worth it. And then you were like, oh, well. And you know what? I'm going to ask you, how did that go?
It was bad, but I'm glad I did it because now we can talk about how bad it was on the podcast. Look, I got to be in the trenches with you.
I guess that's true. It changed everything. Every little tiny piece of dialogue that and every little intricacy was just so slightly off that it felt so weird. Also, Manderly was so ugly. It was the ugliest mansion. Why was it ugly? Do you agree with me? It was so ugly. It was so dark and creepy and weird. It's supposed to be light and creepy and weird.
Yeah. And it's so funny, too, because like, okay, so when the new Mrs. De Winter goes back to Manderly, they put her in the other wing of the house, not the wing of the house that Rebecca and Mr. De Winter used to, like, live in. They're in a new room.
And this is at Maxim's request.
Yeah, at Maxim's request. He doesn't want to be in that room anymore. And initially, the new Mrs. De Winter, she doesn't know that because the room that they're in is so incredibly beautiful. She's like, how could there be another room that's, like... even more beautiful. Yeah. And then she goes into the other room and she's like, holy shit, this room's even more beautiful. But in the 2020 movie, the room that they're given is fucking ugly.
It is. It's a really ugly room. And then like the whole house is so dark with like dark like walnut walls and floors and ceiling. It just has such a weird vibe to it. And I feel like Mrs. De Winter is painted as being such a more confident girl from the start. She has like very little self-doubt, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And there are some weird changes. Let's talk about the horniness. Why was this movie so horny? Rebecca is not innately a horny story until we get to that moment where there's the big reveal of the murder. And then it's like, ooh, murder. And now we can be horny together and it's fine. But this, it was like, damn, they're having like sex at the beach. They're going crazy.
Yeah, just the whole time. And it's also like from the beginning, it was annoying too, because Maxim is played by Armie Hammer.
Yeah. Let's talk about Armie Hammer for a minute.
Oh my God. He's this young little lad.
He is young. Armie Hammer, obviously. Is he still doing anything these days? I think he dropped off the face of the earth when it was outed that he was a cannibal. Do you know about this?
I forgot.
Yeah.
How could I forget?
I don't know. He was accused of sexual misconduct multiple times, I believe. And as a part of that, they revealed, if I recall correctly, they did reveal that, like, his text messages, it revealed that he had a deep-seated cannibalism fetish. And a part of the sexual misconduct was related to that cannibalism fetish. I just really can't remember what. And I don't feel like getting into all the details of that, quite honestly, right now. Very interesting choice to cast him as Mr. De Winter. It doesn't lead to a feeling of security or confidence. It only further fuels all the feelings of uncertainty that I have towards Maxim.
For real.
Though this movie came out in 2020, and I believe that all of the Armie Hammer stuff did come out in 2021, if I recall correctly. Yes. Or it might have been in late 2020. But still, Armie Hammer, he plays a great villain. He is such a scary guy in Sorry to Bother You as well.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
But yeah, it is just weird that he's so young.
Right? It like doesn't make any sense at all.
He's like in his late 20s, I think, when they were filming that. Maybe his early 30s. So right. Yeah, so there's that. We'll start with that. So it's hornier, he's younger, he's Armie Hammer. Rebecca Ghost is real.
You think?
The ghost of Rebecca is for real in that house. She's giving them like nightmares and sleep paralysis. And she is also potentially turning into a flock of swarming birds that keep swarming the house.
Yeah, what was up with that?
What was up with that? I don't know. You know what? I also feel like this is a missed opportunity. Not only did Hitchcock miss this opportunity, but this movie really missed this opportunity, because it would have been perfectly cheesy if they had done it. There's a scene in the book that I really wish that Hitchcock had adapted, and it's when they're driving back to Manderley right before they discover the fire. Mrs. De Winter takes a nap in the backseat of the car, and in that nap, she dreams that Rebecca comes to her, and she finally sees her face for the first time. I wish that we had seen that in the Hitchcock adaptation. I wish that we could have seen what Rebecca looked like. I understand that it's like scarier if you never get to see her face, but it's so captivating to think of the idea that she comes to her in a dream right before discovering that the house is being burned down.
Right.
But this would have been so good and so cheesy in the 2020 movie. And they didn't even do it. They didn't even do it. Missed opportunity.
Instead, the new Mrs. De Winter is having like dreams about being swallowed by vines because there's vines on her blanket in her new room. I'm like, this is boring.
I know. They were doing all the dream shit, and I was like, thank God. She's having all these nightmares, so we're going to get to see Rebecca in the dream at the end of the movie. Mm-mm. Didn't happen.
Nope. Also, in the ending, oh my God, speaking of.
Yeah, okay, wait, before we get to the ending, let's talk about that fancy dress ball scene. What was that? Okay, so we do the whole thing, you know, in the book she wears the wrong dress, she goes upstairs, she cries about it. Maxim's sister is like, it's fine, dear, please come down and just put on your frock and greet the guests, and then you can go back up to your room and be depressed. And that is exactly what happens. And in the movie, however, all the guests start doing a crazy little dance, and then they like point and laugh at Mrs. De Winter.
Yeah.
And then she goes into to the maids' quarters where they're having a crazy poor people party. And she's like, oh, I'm not accepted by the house staff and the lower class people, but I'm also not accepted by all the fancy high class people at the party. No one will take me.
I don't know that the director of this movie saw the Titanic and was like, everybody loves the Titanic.
Really weird choice, especially given that in the book, like, a big part of the drama is that, like, Mrs. De Winter feels horrible for wearing that costume. Not a single person at the party suspects anything is off about her. They all like her.
Yeah.
And it's in her head.
I did think that the people pointing and laughing was also in her head. Like, it was just another continuation of, like,
the, like, know, magical realism. Real life. Yeah.
But it was also kind of stupid.
It was stupid. And then, they show Rebecca's dead body momentarily. That was uncalled for. Yeah. Let's talk about Manderly's burning down. Let's talk about the end. Mrs. Danvers.
What the hell?
Manderly's burning down, and I'm skipping over all the shit about the crime investigation. That was so wrong.
Oh my god,
they got all of that so wrong. But I'm not even going to talk about it. It was so bad.
They changed all of that, and for no reason. The only thing I can imagine is they were like, and which kills me, because, like, I mean, I'm getting angry about imagining this. I don't know this is what happened, but if I had to guess, it would be like, oh, there's not enough suspense in that investigation. We need to make it more suspenseful. And so we're going to raise the stakes by Mr. Danvers getting arrested. And then it's like, and then.
Did you just say Mr. Danvers?
I did say Mr. Danvers. Mr. Maxim. I'm just going to call him
Mr. Maxim.
Mr. Maxim, you can leave that in. That's funny. Maxim getting arrested, and then, oh no, the new Mrs. De Winter has to, like, do a little spy moment and break into the doctor's office by herself. Totally pointless. And also, it's like that scene, like, all of that unraveling in the book is so compelling and so thrilling and very tense, in my opinion. And it's just like, you were like, we could do it better, and you did 10 times worse.
Yeah, so, a million like, times. Yeah, it's so bad.
Yeah.
And then, anyway. And then at the end, Manderly's burning, whatever. And Mrs. De Winter's like, who did this? I know who did this. It had to have been Mrs. Danvers. I'm going to go find her.
Yeah. Again, I saw the Titanic, and we're having the, like, little action moments now.
And so she goes to the seaside, and Mrs. Danvers is, like, standing on the edge of a cliff, and she's just like, I was in love with Rebecca. And then she jumps off the cliff and kills herself.
Yeah.
What?
What? Why?
What?
At least her burning in the house kind of makes, like, sense as a character.
I think that, burning down with the house makes sense as a character. Drowning also makes sense as a character, maybe.
Does it?
If Rebecca had actually drowned.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Did we forget?
I think he forgot. I think he forgot that Rebecca didn't actually drown.
I guess I will admit that I kind of stopped paying attention because I was like, this movie sucks. But I guess we don't technically know that. I don't remember how much in character 2020 Mrs. Danvers knew. Maybe she still thought maybe she was behind on the times and still thought she drowned or commit suicide or whatever.
That is true. She did still think she committed suicide.
Yeah, but still kind of like, I didn't like it personally. I did not care for it.
No, it was really bad. What else has Ben Wheatley done? He did Meg 2, about the Megalodon shark.
Yeah, Kill List, Sightseers,
He High did Rise. A segment for ABCs of Death, which I have seen, and which is fine, but that's all, like, short films.
He did a Doctor Who episode, apparently. Two of them.
Yeah, never heard of any of these, quite honestly. British dark comedy director.
Interesting. Do with that what you don't will. Know why Netflix gave him this project, and it seemed like it had a pretty big budget.
Because it's a Netflix original, I don't think that there is any budget information.
That's fine. I mean, they're going to a bunch of locations. I don't know. It seemed expensive.
People didn't like this one. It doesn't feel good. It's a really bad adaptation, which is sad because it's such a fun story. And I remember actually when this adaptation was first announced, I was like, oh God, I gotta watch that. And then I heard it was really bad and I was like, I guess I won't watch it. And then going back in and watching it, it was like, oh, this is worse than I ever could have imagined. It just feels so flat. It's like in the original, nothing is happening and yet everything feels suspenseful. In this one, everything's happening and yet nothing feels suspenseful. You got it completely backwards.
You fucked it up.
Yeah. Anyway, that's me. And I'm ending my hater moment. Rebecca as a whole is really good and I really like it. And I think that if you're not convinced at this point, you should check it out if you haven't already.
If you liked Oni-sama A.
Well, I think more realistically, if you like Rebecca and you don't know that much about Oni-sama A, even if you're not a fan of manga and anime, I would really recommend checking it out because they are very similar in tone.
Actually, that's more true. Yeah. I feel like Rebecca might appeal to a wider audience.
Rebecca, I think probably more people have read or seen Rebecca than Oni-sama A. But yes, Oni-sama A or Dear Brother, I think by Ryoko Ikeda. You would probably really like it if you like Rebecca because it's very similar tonally.
That's all the thoughts I have.
Yeah, me too. Love it. Glad we did it. Glad I learned that it is gay. Had spent most of my life thinking I really liked this story, but thinking it was a very straight story. And come to find out, as Erica Friedman would say, if I like it, it's Yuri.
Yeah.
Perfect. And lo and behold, perfect. I liked it and it was Yuri. So
thank you, Queer for Fear, for opening our eyes.
Yeah, I never would have thought to do this if we hadn't watched Queer for Fear. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. If you're looking for media recommendations in the dark macabre, check out Queer for Fear too, because you will come away with a lot of stuff to watch. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. If you feel like it, you can follow us on Twitter at gaze. We are just tweeting about episodes coming out at this point, but it is a great place to hear about any updates that we might have. Like this week when we had to delay, we posted that on Twitter. And if you want to DM us there, we will get back to you. It just might not be super timely. You can also get in contact with us by emailing us at erin@gazegaze.com. And you can also send us any thoughts, ideas, or recommendations. We always love to get a recommendation. Many thanks to Kate and Leslie of Neon and Nude for allowing us to use their songs Look and Love and You Pretty Thing for our intro and our outro music. You can and should buy their album at neonandnude.bandcamp.com, or you can stream it on Spotify. Leslie, she also has a bunch of good merch on her website if you want to check it out.
Yep, at lesliehall.com.
Get some holiday presents, perhaps. The last time I went to that website, my browser was like, this website is potentially unsafe, but we can vouch.
It does. I did just go to lesliehall.com and it did tell me it was an unsafe website. However, I know for a fact it is safe. So
it is safe. It's a HHTP website and not like a HHTTSP, whatever, something like that.
Yes. Anyway, lesliehall.com does have the store where she has many a merch, including her gay blanket is available for sale again. So if you've ever wanted the gay blanket, it's back.
The gayest of all blankets.
Shirts and even a statue of Mother Gem herself.
Beautiful. All right. Next week, what are we doing? Is it a Tello movie for the holiday?
It sure is a holiday Tello Films movie. Sorry, my voice is really starting to go away now. We've done a lot of
talking. No, we killed you.
For our next episode, Merry Christmas, it's time again for a lesbian Christmas movie from Tello Films, now streaming on Tello Films. We will be talking about A Holiday I Do.
Wonderful.
Looking forward to watching and talking about what it's about. I have no idea what it's about. I just know that we love Tello. If you're interested in some other lesbian Christmas movies, we have done episodes on other Tello films, including Season of Love, and we even talked with the director and founder of Tello, Kristen Baker, on our episode last July on Christmas at the Ranch.
Two Tello movies this year. Let's go.
I know. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. So,
well, until then, I'm Erin.
And I'm Erin.
And we're gay.
and I'm sick.
Oh gosh, no.
No. Yeah, and I'm also gay.
Yay. All right.
Bye.